But the reality is, if I am the builder, I am in total cost control, and my 100% goal as the builder is to satisfy the developer's investors. And so we're constantly in there negotiating pricing. We're constantly working on things. We also put the stopgap and the fail-safe in there that my construction company signs a guaranteed maximum contract that I personally back up. So my investors never have to worry about cost overruns. And so we're able to create the best of both worlds.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Shannon Robnett has been involved from start to finish on over $350 million in construction projects. Shannon, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Sam. I'm glad to be here.
Absolutely, Shannon. The pleasure is mine. There are three questions I ask every guest who comes on the show. And yes, you have been on the show before. And at some point during this episode, I will figure out which episode that was. And we'll make sure we highlight that out. But either way, for every guest that comes on the show, in 90 seconds or less, can you tell us, where did you start? Where are you now? And how did you get there?
Well, I started at the kitchen table with my parents, watching them do real estate. From there, I grew into a merchant builder and was watching other people. I would build their buildings. They would collect the rents, the revenues. I saw how that was working. In 2001, I built my first investment property. It was an industrial project, and two of my original tenants are still in the building. So it proves that the cash flow model works. 22 years later, same year, I watched my father and mother retire with cash flow and realized that real estate was the way to not only get your time freedom back, but to actually gain real wealth, and time is wealth. And so from there, over the last 3 years, we grew to the point where we needed to start syndicating capital and raising funds. And over the last 3 years, we've raised about $62-63 million.
Wow. That's wild. Good times, man. Merchant builder. I've never heard that term.
Well, that's just where I go to work for other people. You've got a building that needs built. I show up, I build it. And that's my only association with the project.
Got it. When did you start developing or building your own real estate empire of cash flowing properties?
I started that in 2001. Obviously, we downsized that in 2008 and started rebuilding it back in 17.
What happened in that period between 08 and 17 for you?
Well, we just saw, we saw a huge market reset. We saw where, you couldn't build a building for what you could buy one for. So we saw a huge price disparity. Housing went from, a house that was $1 million, you'd see, resold at 500.
Oh, yeah.
As an example, my parents recently sold their house that they purchased for about 400 for 1.9 million. 1.6 million, right? 15 years later, but they bought it at absolutely the bottom. And so with that, we couldn't really get, there wasn't a lot of build jobs happening. There wasn't a lot of development happening, and which has led us to the problem we have today, which is a huge supply constraint where we have, somewhere between 4 and 7 million housing units necessary in America today just to house the current population.
Right, right. So it's kind of gone full circle for you, where it was, nothing to build and there was lots to buy. And now there's lots that needs to be built and maybe nothing to buy.
Right, exactly. Well, and the supply side's coming back online as people run into refinance problems, things like that, perfectly performing assets because we still have a supply disconnect. We've still got supply issues out there, but at the same time, we're seeing a lot more product than we've seen in the last 3 years is coming back to market.
Right, right. And it'll be interesting to see, of course, at what prices those trade based upon inflation or inflation, interest rates, and capital availability. For those of you that don't know, Shannon, you show up on my YouTube feeds all the time. I'm not even searching for you, dude. I'm not even sure what you're doing, but I'm like, oh, there's Shannon Robnett. Oh, there's Shannon Robnett again. So I don't know what your strategy is there, but I just had to point that out on the show.
Well, it's basically pester you till you talk to me, and it seems to be working, right? People are like, how do I get off this YouTube feed? And then we get to talk about investing.
Right, right. Oh, that's really cool. So if you're out there raising capital, go follow Shannon Robnett. I don't even follow him on YouTube. It just keeps showing up. So see what he does there on his social media strategy. It's pretty wild. So what are you building today? What makes sense in today's environment?
You know, a lot of what we've done, so my past, my first project was industrial. And right now, industrial is one of the shining stars in the investment world. And I'll explain in a couple of seconds why, but it's really inflation resistant and always has, but it's never been sexy, right? And the reality is cap rates on industrial have always traded a couple of points higher than multifamily in any market. The other thing that you have is you've got tenants with balance sheets, tenants that are running businesses. You've got tenants that sign personal guarantees, and you've got tenants that sign five-year leases. On top of that, triple net, which is how industrial is leased because of the long-term lease, make all of the taxes, all of the insurance, all the maintenance, all the management, you know, everything to do with the building, a pass-through to the tenant. So your rent is truly your rent. And as we see right now that property taxes are continuing to go up, even though the market has softened, as we see that, you know, insurance is doubling in some areas, tripling in others, this has put a huge crush on NOI in a lot of areas except for industrial, because that is truly a pass-through to the tenant. So it's really been a resilient asset class, and especially in inflationary markets like this, they perform very well. We've got a 37,000 square foot industrial warehouse that we're building for an international stone dealer in Florida right now, looking to build another 40,000 square feet for an aerospace company in the Florida market. We've just acquired something in Houston, Texas, that was a fully stabilized triple net leased industrial product that needed some proper management and some rent escalations in the expiring rents. And so that's really where we've been focusing right now. We're finishing up two apartment complexes that'll come to market here starting Q1 of 23. And both of those should be stabilized and permanent financing on by the end of next year.
That is a lot of moving pieces. I like what you said there about the industrial, the attributes of industrial, such as that you get to pass through all of those expenses. Of course, you know, that is incumbent upon having good tenants that can afford those increases.
Yeah. You know, and the reality is when you look at it, Sam, when you have somebody that's living in your apartment, they are the only way to produce the money. It is their exchange for time that gets them paid. But right. When you look at business owners have already figured out how to leverage, right? They have employees that leverage that. They have distribution cycles and centers that leverage that. And when you pass through a 15% or a 10% increase in their total rent, they just figured out, and usually that just passes on down the line. And now what you're buying on Amazon costs you 15% more, and you don't really notice it because you still need it. So there's a huge difference in what a industrial flex space user will do versus what a tenant will do. Because if you hand him a 10% rent increase, he's got to go give 10% more time that he's already giving 40 or 50 hours to provide what he's got. And he's also dealing with inflationary prices of chicken and fuel and everything else out there that's gone up 2 and 3 times.
That's a really clear explanation that I probably would not have articulated as well. That's awesome. I love that. That makes a heck of a lot of sense. You got two complexes you're finishing up. Are you building any more multifamily complexes, or is that?
You know, we've got a couple on the books that right now, current interest rates versus rent rates have held us off. But I think that you're going to see there's not enough product out there. There's a glut of it kind of hitting the market right now, and stuff that was began in 22 and 23. Or 2021 and 22. So you're seeing some of that, where you're seeing some price softening a little bit, but we're really not seeing occupancy shift much. Mm. And so we think we're going to bring those projects back to the drawing board in probably the second or third quarter of 24.
Got it. Cool. I love this. Shannon, I like the way you're unique in that you're both.
Some people do and some people don't, you know.
What do you mean? Like how you
like the uniqueness. Yes.
Right. Yeah. You're unique. Like a, never mind. I don't know. I could probably find.
I even like the way you put it. I'm unique. Other people use different words.
A pain in the. Anyway, next.
Yeah. Exactly.
Right. So, Man, I don't even know where I was going with this. Oh, you're unique. I was here making you feel good about yourself. You're unique in the way that you guys syndicate your assets, in that generally the builder isn't also the syndicator.
Right.
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 Tell me about that model, how it works, and what are some of the maybe benefits and complications of it?
Well, let's talk about it from the investor's perspective, right? I mean, if I'm going to build something for you, then I'm going to have my price and then you're going to have yours. And there's going to be this battle between you and me for me to make as much money as possible and for you to get it done as cheap as possible. That's sure. Where change orders come in, and they can really play havoc on your project, right?
Yes.
But the reality is, if I am the builder, I am in total cost control, and my 100% goal as the builder is to satisfy the developer's investors. And so we're constantly in there negotiating pricing. We're constantly working on things. We also put the stopgap and the failsafe in there that my construction company signs a guaranteed maximum contract that I personally back up. So my investors never have to worry about cost overruns. And so we're able to create the best of both worlds. Not everybody loves that model, because if something happens to me, something also happens to the syndicator. And so, you know, there is some of that, but a nice insurance policy makes sure that the right people will be hired to take my place. Not enough that it makes me a target, but enough that it makes me, expendable with a replacement. So there's some of that, you know, we've managed to do. But the other thing that we do, Sam, and when we start our process, with the rents. We want to know what the rents are in the area, and then we build our total model backwards. So we're not buying something going, hey, the NOI is $500,000 a year. What can we do to increase that? I look at it and go, I'm going to get an NOI of $500,000 a year. It's going to allow me to build only this much. Right. And so then we build the budget backwards, know that when we're done, we've got a cost model that will work so we can execute on the business plan. Once we've done that, if rents have gone up like they have on these two complexes that we're looking at, we're able to survive the interest rate hikes, which we also modeled at 7.5% on our takeout loans for conservative nature. So we're able to come through it with $200 or $300 better rents than what were projected, ahead of the game, and financed out where we wanted to.
That's awesome. I love that. And I think that's really, it's just a unique product that you're bringing to market, where you can handle both sides of that. So you're finishing up two complexes. I know one of those is at least there in the Boise market. Is the other one also there in the Boise
market? Both of them are here in the Boise market. Yeah.
Boise market. Okay. But you also mentioned that you guys have some assets you're taking down in Houston, some you're taking down in the Florida markets. Mm-hmm. You're kind of all over the country now.
Well, you know, and what we look at too with that, Sam, is we look at the market first. Right. I mean, there's a lot of people that you've met that they look like a fly in a cow pasture. They're running here, they're running there, they're going here, they're going there. And they underwrite this thing. And man, what a magical product it is. It's got the cash flow, it's got everything. And then they go look at the market and they realize that the market isn't an appreciation market, or it's not a growth market. There's not a lot of upside potential there. And so then they realize, well, I can't do this deal because it doesn't fit my buy box.
Right.
And what we've really done is we've looked at it, and there's 8 markets across the nation that we will do deals in, and only those 8. And so when we're looking at things, if it doesn't fit in that market, we've already eliminated a huge swath of what comes across my desk, because we want to be in markets. We want to do a good deal in a great market, then a great deal in a good market. And the reality to that is just simply this. Sam, there's only so much you can do to improve the value of the product that you're working with. There's a lot of things that are external factors, like taxes, like politics, like job growth, like people moving in and out of the area, that you cannot control. But why would you want to do a great deal? We're talking a 12 cap. We're talking about owner financing. We're talking about everything that makes every syndicator salivate, right? In Detroit, right? So, but you chase this deal down and then you realize the market. So we start market first. Once we've identified those markets, it helps us to be coordinated in our efforts. So while it does look like we're in 4 different markets across the nation, moving into 3 more, they're very select markets. And then we go in and acquire multiple assets in that area so that we have a concentration in the area.
How do you build team and manage each of those? I'll just stop the question there. I think, how does that work?
Well, you know, my 30 years in construction experience has really helped me to identify it. When we're going out of state for construction projects, I will go hire a local general contractor, but I will put him through the same process that puts him on my team, right? So we've got a general contractor in Florida that's doing that deal. And I have set up a revenue share with him where every day that he saves me, I will give him 25% of the interest that I would have paid. And I will also give him 35% of the cost savings on the overall budget. So if this contractor is now on my side, he realizes that he can make an 8% profit by giving me a change order, or a 30% profit by saving me money I wasn't going to save if he didn't help me. And so I wind up with the best of both worlds. He's on my team, and we go in and we start that model with conversations and get down to who is the good contractors in the area that have the great relationships, the great reputations. And then we firmly bring them on the team by making it a revenue share so that they can actually make more money saving me money than giving me a change order.
Right, right. Which, boy, that's the name of the game, isn't it?
To absolutely
change order the heck out of a deal. So you've brought the local general contractors on your team. What's that process like for you, vetting another GC? I mean,
it reminds me of, two bulls meeting in a cow pasture, you know. Okay. But at some point you realize that, look, we're on the same team. And when you stop and, you know, think about what my business model is, it makes the most financial sense for everyone involved. And the minute that they see that it is a win-win and it's designed to be a win-win, all of a sudden they're all on board because they know that regardless of what happens to this job, they're gonna make money. If they can make this job go very smooth and execute ahead of schedule and under budget, they're going to be even more profitable. If this job goes long, they'll make what they were supposed to, but it won't be a win. It won't be as big a win as if they put better resources on it. So then we find them going back to their preferred plumber and going, hey, listen, we need you to work on your price a little bit because we really want to work with you on this job because we know you're not going to screw us over. We know you got the manpower, and it really helps our schedule and gets our timing down to where it needs to be.
Got it. No, that's really cool. What about your internal teams? We've talked a little bit about the external teams, the local general contractors, the people like that you're working with around the country, but you need you're involved in a lot of different things. Developing a multifamily complex is very, very different than taking down an industrial asset in Florida.
It is and it isn't, right? I mean, Sam, you're involved in different asset classes than where you started out. If I remember correct, you guys were doing a lot of RV storage and parking lots, and
yep.
Now you're doing, laundromats and some other cash flowing assets,
yep.
But 70% of the underwriting is still the same, right? 70% of the data collection is very similar. And so when we're looking at that, we're able to take the team that we have. And this is the other thing that I have. And I would love to say this is all me, it's all the Shannon Show, but that would be a total lie. I have some of the most amazing team players that are in it to win. And what I figured out how to do is to get them to see what their goals are and magnify those into their jobs so that they're actually achieving their personal goals while they're doing everything around here. And so they're able to see the wins all along the way. And then you really get the motivation up in the office. You get everybody firing on all cylinders. Everybody's willing to jump in and help each other. And you create a team culture that's pretty phenomenal that can't happen if you're not meeting the goals of every person in here. And not all of them are money. And so putting that together and being aware and reciprocative to your staff is some of the best motivation they're going to have. And they'll not only go the extra mile, they'll run an extra marathon for you.
That is really powerful, what you've just described there. But that takes a little bit of, or a lot of bit of empathy, of awareness, of really dialing into the people that are working for you. How do you balance the need to get stuff done and the time that it takes to invest in those employees and say, hey man, like Shannon, what are you like, what's your goals? Like, where are you going with this? Like, and then how do you catalog it and make sure that it kind of fits with what they're doing?
Well, the first thing I do, and this is funny because it throws everybody off. If you've made it through an interview or a second interview and we want to work with you, the last question I'm going to ask you is, what do you want for compensation? And compensation is all about money, right? Yeah. Do you want, do you want heavily, or do you want a better insurance plan? Do you want more time off? Do you want, flexibility? What is it that motivates you? And then the next thing we do is we set out the 12-month goals of where you want to be in that plan. So if, I've got people that are, they're all about time off. I got people that are all about flexibility. I got people that are all about money. I got people that are blended in the middle. But when they realize now that the only thing standing between them and their goals is this silly little project, it's amazing how the attitude shifts and the mindset shifts and the creative juices start flowing. So they figure out their own problems because that's the only thing standing in the way of them and 6 weeks of vacation or them and the flexibility to work from wherever they want.
Right, man, that's brilliant. I love that. I love that indeed. Very, very cool. Shannon, thank you for taking the time to come back on the show today. I was so enamored with our conversation. I didn't actually get to look up the episode, but for those of you who want to look it up, this would be, gosh, at least two and a half years ago, maybe the last time you came here.
It was a while ago.
I certainly appreciate you taking the time to come on today. If our listeners want to get in touch with you and learn more about you and your projects, what's the best way to do that?
Just ShannonRobinette.com. We keep it simple. All of our information is on our website. You can get to all our social channels, our YouTube, even my calendar. If you'd like to book a call and chat more about what we do and how you can be involved, it's just ShannonRobinette.com.
ShannonRobinette.com. We'll make sure we include that there in the show notes. Shannon, thank you again for your time today. I certainly appreciate it.
Thank you, Sam.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor, and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen. If you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much and hope to catch you on the next episode.